Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence, as well as his commitment to our country and his public service to it over many, many years, I have admired greatly, is our first guest. He is Edward Timberlake. He served as an assistant secretary in the Department of Veterans Affairs, capping a career of service in a number of other roles, including in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps. He is a graduate of the Top Gun course as a Marine fighter pilot, and he has also served as a civilian in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, responsible for technology assessment and security. He's a good friend and an author as well of a number of books, many of them dealing with the subject of our talk today, Communist China. Remind me of the name of one of them. Ed, I don't have it in front of me. I apologize.
Oh, Year of the Rat, which was money into the Clinton administration. Red Dragon Rising, which is the money coming out in the form of Chinese mobilization and modernization. Showdown, the potential of what they're going to do with it. And then a technical academic book on the rebuilding of the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. So there are four works that I stand on to your audience.
Let me ask you, just very quickly, we don't have a whole lot of time, but I'm very interested in your professional assessment of what likely went down in the two-hour phone conversation between President Joe Biden and the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping.
Well, Frank, this is probably the most dramatic and dangerous moment in my life experiences. I've been in several wars also, including the Vietnam War. And the reason why you focus in on that, it's so, so important, is that traditionally the president would speak and the Chinese would, you know, sell their bill of goods. And the president, if he had good judgment, would, you know, negotiate, look at it, and come back and make some strong decisions in favor of America. And traditionally, you know, everybody engages with bad people to get good outcomes. And sometimes we get better outcomes than others. Well, the bottom line for me is, after 2 hours of discussion, and one can only imagine with Hunter Biden involved in this and people selling influence and the money being so huge and all the trend lines of various capitulation, the Hollywood crowd, that we are now almost in a situation where an honest media, thank God I'm on your radio show, an honest media would have pulled apart those 2 hours by now. And in my day, even the New York Times and Washington Post, they wouldn't vote for Republican, you know, if it was their uncle. But they definitely were patriots who were worried about America first, and they would deep dive on what the heck happened, and we'd be reading about it. But right now, we can only imagine, and that is really bad, because when your imagination takes over, and you and I both have been in the trenches and in the wars, you know, people like Biden, and I do know Joe Biden from the Hill. I worked on the Hill also. He's the most expedient, glad-handing, and a bully, by the way, and a limited man in the old days. One can only imagine now what his finders are doing. It's very scary, Frank, because we won't know. We can only speculate, and I can only speculate. It's horrible. Standing down over Taiwan, stuff like that.
I'm afraid you're right. You know, I'm not in favor of the unauthorized disclosure of the transcripts of conversations between our president and other foreign leaders, witness in the case of the conversation Donald Trump had with the president of Ukraine, for which he was impeached the first time, let's recall. But this is a moment. This is a moment when it certainly would seem to me the public has a need to know, what did Joe Biden say? Because I think it's fair to characterize his policy as a reversion to that of the Obama administration's kind of policy of managed decline of the United States, in which we accommodate the Chinese, and especially, and just speak to this if you would, you sort of alluded to it, Ed, but if Joe Biden is known by the Chinese Communist Party, particular Xi Jinping, with whom he has spent a lot of time over the years, to be deeply compromised. Isn't it likely that more or less what went down in that conversation is Biden was being told what to do?
Very much so. And let me, I couldn't agree with you more on sharing of classified information. But at this point in any presidential engagement in our lifetime, you would have the backup team, and these are senior backup teams, Secretary of State, National Security Director, and things like that, on background, telling the media how our president stood up to China and made several important points because they want to amplify it. They want to bullhorn it. You don't get that. The absence of a message is really scary because of exactly what you said. It's a checklist to run down. Biden signs up to all of it, probably. We don't know. I mean, groping in the dark on that. But once they go down that path, the more you're compromised, the more you're compromised. So it's just going to snowball. And that's the scary part because there's no checks.
Let me ask you about one issue that I know you've been concerned about for many years, Ed, and that is the story of China's ambition to secure Taiwan's unification with the mainland, whatever it takes to accomplish that. It now seems under Xi that the capacity for the People's Liberation Army to take the island by force is in place. And the signals that are being sent is that that could happen at any time. Joe Biden apparently professed what were described in the little readout we did get on this conversation, fundamental concerns about China's approach to Taiwan. Are you worried that this conversation could well have conduced to, perhaps even a reasonably perceived acquiescence to China's reassertion of its power over Taiwan?
I am very concerned, and historically, very quickly, because on your time's limited, there were two major issues connected to that kind of signaling. First was the Korean War was triggered because Dean Acheson, a very smart man, by the way, and on our side, a very patriotic, smart man, forgot to list South Korea in the Pacific umbrella of American defense commitment. And North Koreans saw that and said, oh, we can go to South Korea. And boom.
Joseph Stalin, more to the point, saw it that way, right?
Yes, true. I'll give you that point. Exactly. He saw it and said, okay, I'm smarter than you. I'm coming. And the other one was Saddam Hussein, lightweight force, but equally diabolical brain. The minute the American ambassador said, well, Kuwait, that's kind of a local problem. Boom. He goes into Kuwait. So these kind of diplomatic level discussions can trigger exactly what you're big fear is. And by the way, in my opinion, I've flown simulators with the Republic of Korea, the Chinese Air Force. I've been in their fighter squadrons flying their F-16 simulators. They are tough, go-for-it people. That island is committed to defending themselves, but they are only 20-some-odd million counting against 1.3 billion. And the weight of communist China looking at them is onerous. My heart goes out to their courage. But if you get a signal that America is saying, well, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we're not quite involved in that, that is a prescription for movement across the channel and also surrendering on a boat. And I always warn Taiwan about that. Be careful. We believe in democracy. And if you vote at Taiwan, the Republic of China, votes for reunification, that's the ballgame. Fortunately, the polling of that does not tell us that they're willing to surrender.
No, to the contrary. They've been voting the other way, I think it's fair to say. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Ed, we will be back to you because these are stories that require our urgent attention, and we especially appreciate your expertise in all of these matters. Thank you for your service to our country, which continues these days, not least as a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, for which I'm very grateful. We'll talk with you soon, sir, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with former CIA undercover operative Sam Faddis about the China threat here and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is Charles Sam Faddis. I think of him as a Renaissance man who has also a distinguished record of service to our country, a variety of capacities in the uniform of the United States Army as an undercover officer of the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency. He served as an assistant attorney general in Washington State. He ran for Congress. He is an author of numerous books, both fiction and nonfiction, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's always welcome here. Sam Faddis, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Sam, I was just talking with our colleague Ed Timperlake, another member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, as are you, and we visited about what could possibly go wrong in a two-hour phone conversation between Joe Biden and the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping. I'd be very interested in your thoughts about that, but most especially against the backdrop of what we know concerning Joe Biden's compromise and that of his family, Hunter Biden most especially, but other members as well, at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, and what it means in terms of more broadly the Chinese operations in this country as well.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that this, in my opinion, is not really just a matter of, you know, Joe doesn't have the necessary intestinal fortitude. He's not tough enough. He's not going to stand up to the Chinese. I think this is really a matter of him being, as you've suggested, completely compromised by the Chinese. And I think that happened some time ago. And so you have a guy sitting literally in the Oval Office now who is really pursuing the agenda of communist China. And I think you are going to see, I think we are already seeing that play out in terms of concrete action. So I give you an example. Right now, there's a lot in the press about a couple of carrier battle groups, U.S. carrier battle groups steaming around the South China Sea or in the vicinity. And it's being played up as this is an example of how Joe is being tough on the Chinese. Well, I would submit to you that that's nothing but sleight of hand. At the same time this is happening, Joe just completely backed off on the Trump policy on Confucius Institutes on U.S. college campuses, which are propaganda arms of the Chinese Communist Party, part of the United Front. So Trump had announced a rule that would require universities to say, to disclose financial connections to these propaganda arms of the Chinese government. While everybody's looking at these carrier battle groups, Joe Biden had that rule quietly withdrawn and has backed away from scrutinizing this activity. And I think you're going to see those kind of concrete things continue to happen.
You mentioned, Sam, United Front operations. Talk a little bit more about that. And again, from the perspective of someone who has operated on behalf of our country in foreign lands, the importance not just of these visible arms of Chinese influence operations like the Confucius Institutes, but the ones that are sort of sub rosa. And I think in that we have to include outfits like Black Lives Matter and Antifa, as well as enterprises like the Liberation Road and the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, and even Seed the Vote has been implicated in some of this. Talk about what the Chinese are doing here in the United States that is not quite as visible as the Confucius Institutes, bad as they are.
Right. Well, I would agree with your assessment that all of those organizations are to some degree or another United Front activities. So certainly the United Front is connected to them. What we're talking about is covert action. Most people think covert action, that means guerrilla forces and blowing things up. There's a whole other world of covert action, frankly, much more expansive, which is political, which is organizing groups, which is sowing dissent, which is basically tearing your enemy apart from within, and the doctrines here are very clear. Divide people on class lines, divide everything you frankly have seen play out in the streets over the last year is classic United Front activity and United Front doctrine. It is designed to destroy your enemy from within, and they are very good at it, and they have a massive effort inside this country to do exactly that.
One other facet of this, of course, is the influence that is extended by China through its connections to major financial houses and leaders on Wall Street. Sam, how does that fit into this doctrine and the enemy within problem that you've just alluded to?
Well, of course, everything that goes on in this world that we're talking about is about leverage, it's about control, it's about manipulation. which is the world of espionage writ large. In general, we now have major U.S. corporations, financial entities that are, first of all, increasingly ideologically aligned with the communist Chinese. But before we even get to that part, they are so in bed with the Chinese communists financially that even if you're just acting on financial interest, increasingly you're doing the bidding of Beijing. That they are the ones that you really have to please and continue to, you know, you got to continue to pay attention to them more than you do to the United States government. I mean, we think of big industrialists and financiers as being somehow the bedrock of the United States. If you look back in the World War II, that's not where we are anymore. We have a lot of people that have sold out to the Chinese communists.
There's a fascinating article. I don't know if you've seen it, Sam Faddis, but Lee Smith has written in Tablet magazine called 30 Tyrants. And he describes it with an historical parallel to what happened in ancient Athens when it essentially lost to Sparta and its own elite turned against the people of Athens. He describes with a particular focus on Wall Street and business leaders and political elites as well, the attitude of many in this country, which is what I would characterize, and said to Ed, and he agreed, I think, the sort of philosophy of the managed decline of the United States that many of these so-called globalists have adopted. How does that fit into this larger rubric of the Chinese trying to use our own institutions in some cases, certainly individual members of influential groups, to destroy us from within?
So I think that's a great analogy. I think it's right on point. That is absolutely true, that you had many very powerful people in Athens who just decided that Sparta was going to win the ongoing series of wars, really, between those two city-states, and decided to change sides. I think there are all sorts of other historical parallels I would cite to you. Constantinople. I mean, the walls were battered down at Constantinople by giant cannons built by a Hungarian Christian cannon maker who had decided time to jump on the other side here. I think that's, for many people, that is exactly where we are. China is the future. U.S. is the past, and they have switched sides already.
This brings me to an expression, I think, of the internal fractures of our country that I wanted to get your thoughts about as well, Sam, especially against the backdrop of what groups like Seed the Vote did to help recruit people to vote against Donald Trump with, it appears, the support of the Chinese Communist Party. We're watching this play out now in the context of a Senate impeachment trial. How does this particular drama figure into the idea that the Chinese are looking for not only the defeat of Donald Trump in this last election, which they've accomplished, among others, of course, but notably, I believe, through their particular engagement. And the apparent purpose of this trial, which is to ensure that Donald Trump cannot ever return to political life.
Well, I would agree with that assessment, and then I would add on to that the fact that it is an attempt to make what I would call a populist movement, which is what Donald Trump is the standard bearer for, so toxic as to drive people away from it without really, and pretending that this is all about issues that it's not really about at all. I mean, what it is about is that this populist movement and economic nationalism and America First is a pushback on all of the things that we've been discussing the last, you know, throughout this conversation. And you know, that can't be allowed to go forward. That threatens everything that we're talking about. So we, you know, and they're very skillful on the other side defining this as well, that's not what this is about at all. It's about racism. It's about white supremacy. It's about systemic racism. It, you know, whatever. They put it into whatever terms are necessary for them in order to win the argument. But that's not really what they're talking about at all. What they're talking about is this movement, allowed to go forward and continue to gather steam, will completely derail their agenda. And therefore, it's not just Trump that has to be killed off metaphorically. It's the movement that has to be destroyed. And therefore, they don't want anybody to be able to stand within a mile of Donald Trump when this is over without being vilified, is really what they're looking for.
This is a subject to which we will return with you soon. Sam Faddis, thank you very much for these insights and for helping connect some very important dots for our analysis of where we are and where we are going to be going if we're not careful. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with former senior Reagan advisor Roger Robinson about Joe Biden's past efforts to help China get access to our capital markets and what he may now do in that regard. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome. We are back and very pleased to have with us a friend of many years, colleague, and, well, freedom fighter. His name is Roger Robinson. He has worked for President Ronald Reagan as his senior director for international economic affairs at the National Security Council, in which role he played an absolutely incalculably important function in helping President Reagan bring down the Soviet Union, structuring the economic warfare strategy that helped achieve that. He has been, ever since, the president of RWR Advisory Group, tremendously important independent research and analysis firm that is particularly specialized in the nexus between national security and economic and financial matters. And he has recently published at rwradvisorygroup.com an important paper about Chinese telecommunications companies that have been listed on the New York Stock Exchange and that are tied to the People's Liberation Army. We're going to talk about that and much more with Roger Robinson. Roger, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
So I have talked on this program and elsewhere, Roger, about the trajectory we seem to be seeing from the Biden administration, even before the two-hour conversation that the president had with Xi Jinping, the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party in recent days. And I characterize it as basically a not Trump policy. That is to say that most, if not virtually everything that President Trump did is being undone. And that seems to be particularly true of the policy towards China. And I would just ask you to set a baseline for what we can expect from the Biden administration. What was the Trump policy, particularly with respect to the portfolio that you've worked so intensively and for so long and with such impact on, namely this sort of financial piece, the underwriting in particular of the CCP by American investors, mostly unwittingly?
Well, it was really under the Trump administration that the capital markets leverage of the United States was first marshaled and deployed. The initiative began on our side in March of 2019, and it was well known by even that time that hundreds of billions, indeed into the trillions of dollars of funds under management of the country, were invested in Chinese entities, both equities and debt. And that something needed to be done because there were numerous Chinese corporate bad actors, national security, human rights abusers, as well as China flouting our disclosure and regulatory standards in this country, including U.S. securities laws that require audits and the like from their American corporate counterparts. So
something that was actually enabled, as I recall, by a memorandum of understanding that Joe Biden helped engineer back in 2013 when he was then vice president of the United States. No,
that waived, in effect, China's requirement to abide by federal securities laws, Dodd-Frank in particular, and accept PCAOB audits, as they're called, Public Company Accounting Oversight Board audits, and they could just give it a miss. That constituted preferential treatment for China that's gone on ever since May of 2013. So all of this came to a head, and publicly in the course of the period between March 2019 and the end of the administration and where we sit today. And it was not long after the surfacing of these issues that we came to discover that the Federal Thrift Savings Plan was about to be also investing in Chinese corporate bad actors, indeed U.S. sanctioned companies, to make matters worse.
And that, of course, was the pension funds of, of federal civil and military personnel.
Yeah, 5.7 million American federal employees, $600 billion pension plan, and all of the international piece of it, the international exposure, so to speak, was going to be in an MSCI index that included many of the most egregious bad actors of China, including Hikvision, that is responsible for what is now being described properly, I think, as genocide against the Uyghurs in Xinjiang through their surveillance cameras and other technical means to keep people incarcerated. So the point is, these are the kinds of companies that were going to be inserted into the portfolios of millions of American federal employees and all of our military personnel. Well, guess what? The military has no interest in financing advanced weapons manufacturers of the People's Liberation Army.
Designed to kill them, after all.
Human rights advocates have no interest in supporting concentration camps. So it was stopped by the president just 2 weeks before it would have gone into effect. And he proceeded to also try to stop other federally administered pension plans from holding bad actor Chinese companies, and indeed Chinese companies at all, in the case of the Federal Thrift Savings Plan.
And also, through other efforts, tried to prevent the investment in People's Liberation Army companies, those directly tied to the PLA, by investors more generally. And so this is the baseline. If it's a not Trump policy approach that we expect under the Biden team, would it be reasonable to anticipate that one of the things they will try to do is clear the decks of such impediments to further investment in what you call bad actor Chinese companies?
Well, that's the fear. I mean, I think that the leverage that the United States has in this area is immense. It is our area of greatest strength, our utter dominance of the global financial system, and China's arguably greatest weakness, which is their voracious need for dollar financing on a large scale every year that can only be acquired from markets as deep and voluminous as the U.S. capital markets. So this is a very specialized area of tremendous leverage, and at the same time should join trade and technology right at the top of U.S.-China relations as a consideration. So the Biden administration would be well served to do that, but then again, Wall Street is lobbying very heavily to ensure that these Trump gains in the areas of national security, human rights, and investor protection are reversed or watered down or made otherwise ineffectual, because it's hurting Wall Street fees and it's hurting Chinese companies that want to partake of our capital markets and earn those fees for issuing bonds and IPOs and the like. So this is the concern, and hopefully the administration will realize that this is something that can materially advance the security, human rights, and investor protection agendas of the United States. And
let's talk about each of those. Yeah. In regards to investor protection, the Congress has unanimously, amazingly, on both sides of the Hill, unanimously adopted legislation, not perfect, but still the intent is quite clear, to stop the sweetheart deal that has given rise to arrangements with Chinese companies, investments in them that do not have the best interest of American investors and their financial protection at heart. We have had the Congress support the idea of designating companies as People's Liberation Army companies. And the previous administration took the step of trying, as I said, to impede investment in those by American investors. There does seem to be a need for a similar kind of concerted action against companies in China that are implicated in these human rights abuses. You mentioned notably the Uyghurs, Muslims in Western China, but other ethnic minorities have also been subjected to genocide. And God knows the Tibetans, the Mongolians, and others have been oppressed terribly, as well as the people of China more generally. What can be done in regard to these companies that are implicated in such oppression or helping the Chinese implement it, perpetrate it?
Well, first, Frank, I would just go back and reaffirm your point about the strong bipartisan interest in the Congress and having the Pentagon identifying which Chinese companies are affiliated with the People's Liberation Army. It took them 20 years to follow the law, but they did so in the course of 2020. And and most importantly, the president then issued an executive order, 13959, that basically said no U.S. investors, institutional or individual, can hold the securities, read stocks and bonds, of the companies on that list, of which there are 44 really big Chinese companies right now, after November 11th of this year, that it's prohibited, and the subsidiaries, and the backdoor through which Chinese companies most often enter our markets surreptitiously, in effect, through the index funds and exchange-traded funds. So all of that was covered, and it's the first time that meaningful capital market sanctions have ever been used by the United States to advance critical security interests against nothing short of America's premier existential threat.
Very, very quickly, just catch us up on the human rights piece of this, Raj. We got less than 30 seconds.
Yeah, the human rights piece should have a comparable list. Companies that are aiding and abetting genocide in the case of the Uyghurs, the surveillance state and the like, and the same kind of capital market sanctions should be applied. That, you know, you're just not going to fund with American retirement dollars and other investment dollars, unwittingly, unknowingly, these kind of cataclysmic human rights abuses.
Roger, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. This is a really important idea, and we will be building on it in the days ahead, I can guarantee you. Next up, we'll speak with Susan Katz Keating about the curious demise of a Capitol police officer and the morale of our military now under assault. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and let me say a special welcome to an award-winning writer and investigative journalist by the name of Susan Katz Keating. She is a return guest, for which we're very grateful, and the chief national security correspondent at Just the News. She has worked in a number of other outfits, including the Washington Times, and she has published widely in other periodicals and has several books to her credit, including Prisoners of Hope, Exploiting the POW/MIA Myth in America. Susan Keating, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Good morning, Frank. It's great to be here.
I wanted to talk with you about a couple of things, but think it's particularly important, given what's been going on Capitol Hill over the past couple of days, to start with a subject you address in your piece at Just the News today, in which you talk about the fate of a man who featured prominently in the House manager's case against Donald Trump, namely Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who we were told perished as a result of injuries sustained in the course of the mob violence and insurrection prompted by Donald Trump, incited by him on Capitol Hill. Tell us what you've discovered about what actually transpired, or for that matter, what is not possible to ascertain at the moment about this man, who, whatever the cause of his demise, is obviously mourned as a hero. But what do we know, and what don't we actually know?
It's so sad what happened. You know, this brave Capitol Police officer died, but we don't know why. And the police medical examiner, the chief medical examiner in D.C., just told me as of yesterday, they don't have the autopsy results, and they don't know when they're going to have them. So it's this very sort of amorphous. The man died. He died in the hospital after engaging with protesters. And there was just a whole lot of rumor and myth about what happened to him. And a lot of the press published that he was bludgeoned with a fire extinguisher. But there's no documentation on that. So there's no actual proof so far that has emerged that he was hit with a fire extinguisher. And he went to the hospital after he was, engaging with protesters, and then he died the following day.
I understand that he actually called his brother after the incident on the Hill and told him he was fine. And after Revolver and now you and others have been raising some very serious questions about the narrative of this, instrument of blunt force being used to, cause him mortal injury, we've been given to understand that, well, maybe it was bear spray that apparently some of those in the crowd used against the officers. Is there any evidence of that either? And also, it is peculiar, is it not, that it's taking this long for the autopsy to be released? And apparently, of course, he was cremated, but he was cremated very, very quickly as well. Does that figure into why this story is so hard to nail down?
Well, if he's been cremated, then obviously they can't exhume his body to do additional tests. So everything we know is going to have to come from the initial autopsy that was performed. Now, the medical examiner tells me that they technically have 90 days, but that it may go longer. And I'm not sure why it would take them this long to release the results of this autopsy. And yeah, it's very puzzling.
Puzzling is a charitable way to put it, among other things that are puzzling about this whole story. Susan, let me turn to another topic with you here that I think also warrants our attention. In the aftermath of the incident on Capitol Hill, and let me just emphasize, this is not meant to suggest that it was not deplorable, what was done there. But it was done by a relatively small number, though an awfully large number of people have been, I think, unfairly implicated in it, including a lot of people who were there to try to, or brought there to try to secure the Capitol, namely National Guard members. There was almost immediately commenced investigations of them to establish whether they would be loyal to Donald Trump or faithful to their oath to the Constitution. And this has now turned into, it seems, an awfully lot larger, witch hunt, some have called it, of military personnel throughout the ranks. Talk a bit about what former General, now Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin is doing in this regard, and concerns that it may be raising.
Well, as you said, it's very concerning. Is Austin has ordered a one-day stand down throughout the ranks. So commanders are to set aside a day to discuss extremism in the ranks. And from the people I have spoken to, this is having an absolutely chilling effect because the frontline troops especially, they think that they're being targeted or that they're being singled out or they're suspect, unjustifiably so. to the point where like certain long time symbols are now being, you know, banned, including some symbols that were used as morale patches by some units.
Can you give me an example of what you're talking about there?
Well, there's in one special operations unit, there was an old, like a long time morale t-shirt that was used, that used the 3 percenters symbol. And this completely was related to, you know, the fact that 3% of, you know, Americans were thought to have fought in the Revolutionary War. Well, now the 3 percenters are believed to be extremists, and this symbol is considered, you know, a radical symbol. And so these t-shirts and these, you know, patches now they cannot be used. And some of these t-shirts were issued by the units themselves.
Clearly, before there was a contemporary group called the 3 percenters, these were people who were imbued with a sense of history, and the degree to which a very small number of people actually have in the past helped determine the course of American history, and that may well be the case today as well, albeit in a very different direction. Let me ask you, Susan, more broadly, you follow closely the state of our national security, and the morale of our military is always a somewhat subjective proposition. It's usually anecdotal, and it can't always be said with certainty that sort of certain insights are more generally applicable. Having said all that, do you have a sense of how the military is responding to the new Biden team and the direction that it's taking, notably in regard to this kind of stand down, but also the reinstitution of things like critical race theory training and the like that really bespeaks the transgender, you know, executive order, that bespeaks a sort of return to the social engineering of the military by the Obama team?
Some of the people that I have talked to have said, like, what's this all about? We're professional soldiers. Let us just be, and let us be neutral as we always are. But I think that there's like a real sense of unfairness, particularly regarding these, you know, the stand downs and the extremism, and the notion that it's really applying to one group of extremists and not others. Because as you can recall, there was an incident of extremism in the military when an Army major, a psychiatrist, opened fire on other soldiers. And he shouted Allah Akbar before he went on his rampage. And that was classified as workplace violence. But there was a huge push not to acknowledge that it had anything to do with extremism.
And unfortunately, there have been a number of incidents of that kind, I think, where not perhaps as egregious as that, but people with a certain propensity, shall we say, for jihadism were discovered and in some cases did real damage. So that's a clear problem, and we will be tracking closely with your help, I hope, in the days to come, Susan, others that may manifest as a result of some of these other policy changes and their implications for the good order and discipline of our armed forces. Thanks for covering it so well at Just the News and for coming to visit with us about it from time to time. I look forward to talking with you again soon, and to the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.